Second case is United States v. Mueller. Counsel, is it Mueller? Mueller? It's Mueller? Okay, thank you. United States v. Mueller. Is the appellant prepared to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court. May it please the court. I am Mark Brueger, and along with my co-counsel, Major Yolanda Miller, we represent the appellant of this case, Airman First Class Jordan Mueller. Chief Judge Stuckey, with your permission, we'd like to reserve 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. The Uniform Code of Military Justice requires identical appellate rules among all the services regarding any course of action any appellant may take. Now, despite this uniformity requirement, and in direct contravention of this court's precedent, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals implemented a rule that placed a greater appellate burden on airmen than their sister service brethren. The Air Force Court then utilized this rule to deny Airman Mueller's timely attempt to assign errors, thereby depriving him of his due process right to appeal. Given these facts, this court should hold the offending rule invalid, set aside the Air Force Court's decision, and remand the case to provide Airman Mueller his substantial right to an Article 66C review. In addition, this court should decline to absolve the government for its failure to compile a complete record of trial and conclude that where a court of criminal appeals determines that a record needs correction, RCM 1104D1 required a certificate of correction. Now, turning first to Issue 1 and the invalidity of Rule 15.5, which is the offending rule in this case. Now, Rule 15.5 under the Air Force Court rules is invalid for at least four reasons. First and foremost, and quite clearly, this is a rule that applies to external entities, namely the parties. Now, as this court's precedent in Gilley noted, Joint Rule 26, which is the uniform rule that was implemented by all the TJAGs together that provides uniformity across the services, Joint Rule 26 limits the CCAs to promulgating only internal rules. And those internal rules were defined as rules applying to the internal workings of the court. Any rule that applies to an external entity, i.e. a party, is therefore beyond the rulemaking authority of the CCA. So Rule 15.5 on its face is invalid because it applies to the parties. One of the reasons, or one of the ways it affects the parties, is it applies a 10-day deadline to file a brief for a case that has been remanded back to the convening authority in a non-rehearing matter. Specifically,
counsel, on that particular point, though, didn't the appellant meet that deadline by filing within 8 days?
Your Honor, it has always been our contention that we met that deadline,
and that's the government's contention also.
I think that is their contention as well, Your Honor. The problem here, though, is that the Air Force Court rule itself requires that the 10-day deadline begin when the case is redocketed. And the Air Force Court declined to redocket the case. We don't know when they redocketed. So our position has been that the true deadline, when it actually starts, that 10-day clock started on November 30th. And that was the day that the Air Force Court actually accepted the government's filing correcting the record. Because it's our position that we can't actually file a supplemental assignment of errors if the record's not complete yet.
Let me ask the question just very directly. What is the appellant's position? Did you file within the deadline specified by Rule 15.5? In other words, even if Rule 15.5 is valid, which is not your position, but even if it is valid, is it your position that you complied with it?
It's our position that we complied with it, but, Your Honor, there is ambiguity there. And the government's brief notes that because the case was actually returned to the court on the 20th of November.
But my difficulty is the government also agrees that you complied with it, and I just don't know what we're doing invalidating a rule that, because it's in conflict, if your position and the government's position is both that you complied with it. Why don't we just get to the merits of the case?
So, Your Honor, there's two reasons that we believe that this rule applies to Airman Mueller and why it's invalid. The first reason is the 10-day deadline. And just so we're clear here, Your Honors, again, the case was returned to the court on the 20th of November. So that theoretically could be the date that it was returned. So if the date was 20th of November, we actually failed to meet that 10-day deadline. Again, it's our position we did meet that because it wasn't actually accepted until the 30th, but there's ambiguity there. So that's our first position with the deadline. But the deadline does not just limit the brief to appellants that file within the 10 days. It actually precludes appellants from raising any issues if they actually failed to file an initial pleading and assignment of errors, which is what happened in this case, Your Honor. And that's
Mr. Ruger, I hate to interrupt you, but because I know, were you finished answering Judge Maggs's question? Or does Judge Maggs feel his question's been answered so far?
Oh, please go ahead.
All right. Speaking of not knowing things, it's not clear to me the denial by the CCA of your motion. It's not clear to me what the reason was. I mean, there's an order saying it's denied with a big stamp on it, denied. But what's the reason for denying it? The government seems to have one view of why it was denied, and you seem to have another view in your brief, at least, of why the motion was denied. But what's the reason the motion was denied? And doesn't that affect how we proceed further beyond that into the merits of the issue?
Your Honor, this is almost the exact same scenario that confronted this court in United States v. Mitchell, where the CCA declined to review some issues that the appellant attempted to raise and then did not articulate the reason for why it denied it. And what this court actually talked about was leaving this court to speculate as to the reasons for denial was a shoe that pinches the court's toes. And that's exactly kind of what happened here. But I'll tell you why.
Who wrote that?
Yeah, I don't know. I love the line. But the reality here, though, Your Honor, if you look at the timing, is we know that 15.5 applied. We know it applied. Now, the government argues that relevance and ripeness were the reasons that the court denied it. But if relevance and ripeness were the reasons, under 15B, appellant was allowed to raise any issue within 60 days of the case returning to the court. The Air Force Court's decision was dated on the 21st of December. That was a little more than 30 days after the case was initially returned to the court on the 20th of November, and I guess 22 days after they accepted the certificate of correction. So even if it was relevance or ripeness, the Air Force Court should have allowed appellant additional time to submit matters, and they failed to do so.
Well, why wouldn't we just send it back to the CCA and let them tell us why they denied the motion?
I think that's exactly what we're asking for, Your Honor. I mean, that's the problem. That's the root of this problem, Your Honor, is that Airman Mueller attempted to raise an issue that occurred exclusively on remand. This is not a scenario involving piecemeal litigation where he filed a merits brief and then said, oops, my fault, I have something else to consider. These were issues that occurred exclusively during remand that the Air Force Court declined to consider we believe it's 15.5 clearly applies because that's the only rule that applies to supplemental pleadings. But because they failed to articulate the reasons for it, we believe that this court should actually remand the case back. And we also believe that
Should we provide any further guidance, or should we simply send it back asking for explanation?
Your Honor, the fact that they denied review at all, we believe, was a violation of his due process rights. Article 66 review is a substantial right. And where that right has not been given to an appellant, that is materially prejudicial to that appellant. And that's what occurred here. Under Rule 15B, Airman Mueller had 60 days to file a supplemental AOE for the Air Force Court's consideration. He definitely met that deadline. Under any stretch, even the government has conceded that point. He has met that deadline. He was afforded a right to have the Air Force Court consider those issues. And their failure to do so, they stripped him of his due process rights to consider the issues on appeal, especially for a first right of appeal as it was in this case, Your Honor. So if you're asking for a recommendation, yes, our request is that you remand the case and have the Air Force Court actually consider the underlying issues, Your Honor.
Counsel, on that point, why do we need to remand the case? I mean, if we agree with you that this material should have been considered, can't we just consider it now, and if we determine that it has no merit, just affirm the court below?
Your Honor, I think it has to do with the underlying issues themselves. We believe, first and foremost, that the merits of the issues in general don't matter at this point in time because the Article 66 review was never actually completed here. This was Airman Mueller's first bite at the appellate apple, and that never occurred. So that is materially prejudicial, and we think that the CCA is required to actually review those issues. But even if this court were inclined to decide this case, we believe that you should not exercise that option in this case because the underlying issues themselves relate to something that's in the exclusive province of the CCAs, and in particular the post-trial delay. Now, we raised the post-trial delay under both a due process issue and under TARDIF, And Tardif is for sentence appropriateness under the exclusive province of the CCA. So we believe that if this court were to step in, that would deprive the appellant of his right to have that exclusive issue decided by the CCA.
What about the unlawful command influence? Suppose we look at this and we say we don't interpret the word verify the same way appellant does. We think it just meant check whether it's true or not, not that you have to do it. Could we decide that issue on the grounds that the CCA had no justification for borrowing it based on timing, so it was properly before the CCA, so it's properly before us, and looking at it, we agree or we disagree with that interpretation. I don't mean to suggest we agree or disagree, but that we could decide the UCI issue in the first instance.
No, and we understand that, Your Honor. Again, it's as a starting point, it's our position that if this court were to decide to weigh in on that issue, Airman Mueller would never have gotten that first bite at the appellate apple. So we think that's problematic. We also believe that the UCI issue potentially involves the CCA's fact-finding authorities, and so that they should be sent back for additional fact-finding, which, again, falls under the...
Can I just ask you to spell out a little bit more of your first point there?
Yes, Your Honor. So we believe that, and based on this court's precedent with Jenkins and with Grosstefan, that we believe that an appellant in a first appeal of right is allowed to raise any issue that he or she wants in front of the CCA, and the CCA is required to review those issues, assuming the appellate rules of procedures were followed appropriately, which they were in this case. And the failure of the CCA to do that in this particular circumstance materially prejudiced Airman Mueller because his substantial right to Article 66 review never occurred.
But are you referring to this now in the UCI context? I'm building upon the question posed to you by Judge Mack.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm referring to it in both contexts. To be honest, we don't think the merits of the underlying claim actually matter for this Court's consideration. What we're focused on here is that the CCA had a statutory obligation to review the issues that Airman Mueller timely raised, and they failed to do so. So they stripped him of their statutory obligation to review that, and he did not have his Article 66 review.
Either via Grosstefan or regularly.
Yes, Your Honor. We don't believe there's any difference between the two in terms of their requirement to review, though. I mean, the government's brief tries to distinguish between the two.
Well, yeah.
For review purposes, Your Honor, the government...
For formal review purposes.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. We would posit that, as this Court has made note time and time again, and Matthias is a good example of it, is that when an appellant raises a Grosstefan issue, and again, Grosstefan is defined as potentially a frivolous issue that an appellate counsel cannot ethically raise, even for these frivolous issues, the CCA is required to at least put in the record that they considered those issues. Now, these were two issues, regardless of the merits.
Understood. Yeah. Understood.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
So I think getting back, Your Honor, to Judge Mack's point here for that initial AOE requirement, that is the particularly egregious aspect of this rule that requires this Court's attention. Now, Gilley is almost directly on point with what occurred here. In Gilley, the Air Force Court implemented a rule that only gave appellants 7 days to respond or to provide an AOE for remanded cases. Now, this rule is 10 days. But the egregious part of that is, again, it precludes an appellant from raising any issues that occur exclusively during that remanded process if they failed to raise the issue, if they failed to raise an AOE in the beginning. And that's what occurred here. And that simply can't be the rules, Your Honor. That would give the government carte blanche to do or not to do anything that they wanted if they've actually committed an error that required a remand in the first place. And that is the problem here, Your Honor. Airman Mueller never had an opportunity to raise these issues to the court's consideration, and that violated his due process rights. Now, moving on from that, Your Honor, and just briefly, we're going to stand on our brief mostly for the advisory opinion aspect of the certificate of correction issue. But we would like, again, to note that the discussion section, which the government never addressed in their brief, the discussion section quite clearly states that if a record of trial is to be corrected, it's to be corrected through a certificate of correction. So we believe that when reviewing Issue 3 about whether or not a certificate of correction is required, 1104D1 basically says it gives the court permissive authority that if they believe an error is egregious enough, either qualitatively or quantitatively, they may refer it back to the convening authority. Now, an error
might
not be.
So why do you think the CCA thought it was mandatory?
I don't believe the CCA thought it was mandatory, Your Honor. I think that's the problem with the government's brief, is they're they've made this question one where the CCA believed it was required. There's nothing in the record to believe that the CCA thought it was required. This could be, I mean, this could be a permissive, and as the government concedes, this is a permissive authority and permissive act by the CCA. But again, I'd like to see what the government's answer is to that persuasive authority in the discussion section that it is to be corrected through a certificate of correction. Any further questions, Your Honor?
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court. May it please the court. I'm Captain Peter Kellett, along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ann Payne. We represent the United States in this proceeding. This court should hold that remand is unnecessary in this case and affirm the findings and sentence which the lower court did. In addition, it should also find that certificates of correction are not the only means to correct a record and that the lower court...
Do we have to get into that at all? Or is that some abstract question floating out here?
Well, Your Honor, it's the government's position that it is a justiciable issue.
Well, it may be justiciable. I don't grant that. But do we have to answer it to get rid of this case?
Well, arguably this court could decide this case on issue two or issue one alone.
Right.
Issue
that's three, what I'm really getting at. If we hold this reg is invalid because it's non-uniform, does that end the case?
So no, Your Honor, I would submit that this court could still decide the issue.
Well, now you're telling me what we can do. I'm saying what do we have to do?
Well, this court should decide issues one and two for sure, Your Honor, but it would not have to just because it finds...
Well, if you take the appellant's argument that it was obvious that his pleading was rejected because of 15-5, and you hold 15-5 is invalid, why do you have to answer two? Two's frosting on the cake.
So I agree that if this court finds that Rule 15.5 was invalid and it was the reason for the pleading being rejected, remand would be an option, but this court should not remand this case because it can decide the issues before it. For example,
is there some doubt in your mind that Air Force 15.5 was the basis for the CCA's opinion here?
No, Your Honor. I think the record shows that relevance was the reason for the rejection of the supplemental plea.
So you don't think that 15.5 resolved this case at the CCA?
No, Your Honor.
So how does that fit in terms of the fact that they decided this matter before the time ran under the joint rule?
The 16-day timeline?
60.
The 60-day timeline.
Right. Well, Your Honor, if they weren't using 15.5, how could they have decided this case before the time ran?
Well, Your Honor,
the joint rule.
So in this case, the supplemental pleadings were based on motions to attach documents, and those were the sole factual predicates to support the supplemental assignments of error. And since those documents were rejected by the CCA, the court did not need to address the supplemental pleadings because there was absolutely no factual predicate upon which to base the supplemental pleading.
Counselor, could you respond to the appellant's argument that while this court could perhaps review in the first instance, or I should say without the benefit of any opinion from the CCA, the UCI claim, that the TARDIF claim is different and that the CCA really has to weigh in on that in the merits in the first instance?
Well, Your Honor, I think this court can answer that question by addressing a matter of law under TARDIF, and that's whether or not relief would be meaningful in this case. Appellant requested 75 days off of his term to confinement, his sentence to confinement, and this court held in Rodriguez-Rivera that granting confinement relief when the appellant has already been released from confinement is not meaningful relief as a matter of law. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Appellant was released from confinement in January of 2018. The delays in this case didn't occur until October of 2018. Therefore, providing confinement relief in this case would not be meaningful relief. And that's that's a matter of law that this court can address to resolve the issue. Which goes back to...
Can I just jump back to the question I had before, though?
Yes, Your Honor.
Just so you can clarify it in my mind, you're saying the reason 15.5 wasn't applied here is because they decided on relevance grounds and so forth, and the reason that the 60-day timeline under the joint rule doesn't indicate the opposite is because there was nothing in front of the CCA of any consequence for them to decide. But didn't appellant have those 60 days to submit an issue? So doesn't that undermine your argument completely?
Well, I think it would go to prejudice at that point. In the appellant's motion for reconsideration and now an appeal to this court, appellant has not identified any matter that they were not able to raise due to the 60-day
time. But aren't we jumping ahead at that point? I mean, don't we just look at, okay, they were using 15.5, it conflicted with the joint rule, send it back. Why are we going to the next steps, saying, well, we don't have any proffer from the appellant about what they would have raised in the 60 days and so forth?
When United States versus Gilley, this court found that appellant was unable to identify prejudice. Specifically, they weren't able to identify any supplemental pleadings that they would have raised had the court not denied the motion to attach the supplemental pleading that was at issue in that case. And this court should also apply the same reasoning here, that there's no prejudice in terms of extra supplemental pleadings that they already didn't file that were rejected by the CCA below. And specifically to the two motions to attach, the first motion to attach was actually rejected twice by the lower court. The first time, the appellant motioned to attach that document, he basically raised the same reason for attaching the document to the lower court. To support a claim of UCI and also to support a post-trial delay claim. And 15.5 was not at play at that time. This was before the record had been returned to the CCA. There was not a timing issue. The government opposed the motion to attach based on relevance, and the lower court denied the motion to attach. It stands to reason that it was for relevance reasons, and it also stands to reason that the second time it was rejected is for the same reason, for lack of relevance, because appellant did not raise any new reason to attach the document to the record when he filed a supplemental AOE. With regard to the second motion to attach appellant's declaration, it was also similarly rejected for relevance and ripeness issues. Ripeness with regard to the Moreno claim. I understand now the focus is on the Tardif issue, which does not have a similar ripeness concern. But even then, the declaration was not relevant because it was factually impossible for appellant's declaration to support a claim of prejudice. In his declaration, he submits that he was unable to find employment from January 2018 to May 2018. Well, the remand in this case didn't occur until October of 2018. So the remand it would have been impossible for the remand to affect his ability to find employment 5 months prior. In addition, as this court found in United States versus Allende, that's spelled A-L-L-E-N-D-E, and the citation is 66 MJ 142, this court rejected an appellant's declaration where the appellant tried to raise a claim of prejudice because he did not substantiate his claim that he was unable to find employment due to the lack of an issuance of a DD Form 214, which is similar to appellant's argument in this case. So for those reasons, the declaration was also not relevant and properly rejected by the lower court. And what is left is the record.
Captain Kulik, regarding the first time the motions to attach the documents were made and the CCA denied those motions, did they articulate a reason for as relevance, or you're going through the record? You said you point to the record to show that there could have been no other reason except for relevance, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did they articulate that as their reason?
So there's no articulated reasoning. There's no explicit reasoning from the lower court, but the government's position, it is a reasonable inference to conclude that relevance was the reason. Due to the government's opposition to the motion to attach based on relevancy reasons, and then the court's denial, subsequent denial of that motion to
withdraw. Why shouldn't this court be concerned about that? Why wouldn't we be incentivizing CCAs to not disclose in their opinions the bases for their opinions and thereby making it unreviewable by us, essentially? Why shouldn't we, in this instance at least, send it back and say, show your work?
Well, Your Honor, there would be a considerable strain on the lower courts due to the amount of motions that they have to deal with in every case. But
simply say, we used AF 15.5? What about the burden on this court?
Understood, Your Honor. But even if the court is concerned, this court could still address that in this opinion to the lower courts, that this is not the best practice for these reasons, because this court may be in a position where it would not be able to, but the government not be able to review why or the underlying reason for the denial.
But you see, that goes to my concern. You're saying we should say this handcuffs our ability to review the lower court's work. So I'm saying, wouldn't we be incentivizing CCAs not to disclose their reasoning? And isn't that, not to put too fine a point on it, but essentially a corruption of justice?
In the right case, absolutely, Your Honor, but the government's position is that is not the case here. Because while this court is absolutely, as a matter of law, or can, as a matter of law, review a lower court's decision to attach a document to the record, as this court found in Brock, it can review for abuse of discretion. And that goes to your concern about, Judge Olson, whether or not you can review for abuse of discretion if there's no reasoning outlined by the lower court. But here in this case, even if this court were to review the document anew, de novo, it would find that it's irrelevant to any claim of UCI based on just the plain language of the convening authority's memorandum that appellant attempted to attach to the record.
It's irrelevant, or it doesn't make it out.
Excuse me?
It's irrelevant, or it qualitatively doesn't do the job. It sounds to me what you're saying. As I understand the government's argument on UCI, it is that a plain reading of this shows clearly there's no UCI.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's not a relevance argument. That's an argument that they didn't make their case.
Well, so the government's position is in terms of whether or not a document is relevant to attach to the record, this court should use the definition in Military Rule of Evidence 401, and whether or not the document has a probability to
making more likely.
Yes, Your Honor. And based on that standard, it's irrelevant, and the CCA properly denied the motion to attach. And this court should also be satisfied that the CCA conducted its tardif review in this case, even though the motions to attach were denied, because the CCA, this is a case where the presumption should not be disturbed, that the CCA understood its duty and actually carried out its duty to review for tardif. Because in this case, the CCA was absolutely aware of the delays because it granted the government's enlargements of time. So there's no question whether or not they were aware of these delays and the reasoning behind them, because they were requested to grant the delays. So they understood the reasoning and stated in their opinion that they carried out their duties under Article 59A and Article 66 Charlie. Thus, the lower court did not err nor violate appellant's due process right to an appeal. And if there are no further questions on the first and second issues.
Yeah, I have one last question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't the fact that you think the motion was rejected based on relevance and your colleague thinks it was based on something else, the rule, doesn't that suggest that we send it back and ask for clarification, if nothing else? I mean, I know your argument is that it's you can look at the motion, your response to it, and determine that it was denied for lack of relevance. But doesn't that require you to speculate as much as it requires the appellate defense counsel to speculate?
Well, Your Honor, I would agree if appellant had only filed the motion to attach the document one time when he attempted to file his supplemental pleading, his supplemental assignments of error, and that was the only time it was submitted and rejected. But it was rejected previously 2 months prior when timing was not an issue at all. And he's basically proffered the same statements as to their relevance, as to why they should be accepted under the lower court's Rule 23.3 Bravo, which requires the moving party to demonstrate relevance. Because of that, because there are two occasions in this case, and one of those cases absolutely did not rely on 15.5 or timing at all, this court should be convinced that it was relevance and not 15.5 the second time as well.
First time that he filed, did he have the supplemental assignments of error?
He did not, Your Honor, but in his motion to attach the document, he signaled that he planned to use the document to file a supplemental pleading for UCI.
But, I mean, were they relevant unless and until he filed the supplemental pleading? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would submit that the lower court was able to identify that there's no way that that would the convening authority's memorandum could support a claim of UCI based on his proffer in the motion to attach the document. And he absolutely could have corrected that when he actually filed his supplemental pleading or gathered more documentation to support his claim of UCI, but he didn't do so. He submitted the same proffer to support the motion to attach that document the second time. Moving on to the third issue. First, this as I opened in response to Chief Judge Stuckey's question, this is not advisory and similar to the court's decision in Wilson where the court decided whether an Article 12 whether Article 12 applied to military members serving confinement in civilian detention facilities, even though it was already decided that the appellant had not been confined with foreign nationals in that case. And this court found that it was not advisory there because the issue was interwoven with the resolution of his complaints about confinement conditions. Here, the issue of whether certificates of correction are always necessary is also interwoven into appellant's complaints about post-trial delay in UCI. Further, even if this court does find that it could be advisory or in fact is advisory, this court has recognized there's not an absolute bar in answering the question, even if it finds it if it's advisory, because this court is a supervisory court. And part of its duty is to ensure that the lower courts and appellate counsel are correctly interpreting its law or its opinions. And here, the government would never be in a position to challenge a lower court's interpretation of RCM 1104D because by the time the court renders a decision, the record would have necessarily been corrected. So the government would never be able to challenge this. And here, AFCA's decision, the lower court's decision, was in conflict with this court's precedent, saying that certificates of correction are not mandatory, and also the other service courts. In its order to remand the case, AFCA cites only RCM 1104D as the only way to correct a record, which is not in line with this court's precedent or the sister service courts. And based on the facts of this case, the lower court erred when it denied the initial motion to attach the enlisted performance report.
Counsel, what's your response to the discussion to that rule, which seems to suggest that it should be corrected using a certificate of correction?
Yes, Your Honor. So the discussion section is obviously not mandatory law. It's persuasive to interpret maybe some of the reasonings for the RCMs. But this court has consistently held since the 70s that the manual for courts martial does not absolutely require certificates correction. And that has been consistently applied by this court and the service courts and also interpreted the same way by the service courts. And there's no reason to disturb those precedents.
But in this case, going to the issue of whether it is improvidently granted, the CCA issued a show cause order to the government saying, why doesn't 1104D apply? If this particular CCA panel believed that it was mandatory, they would not have done a show cause order. So why are you concluding that the CCA felt that they were required to have a certificate of compliance here?
Well, I think the government would disagree that it didn't believe that just because that wasn't obvious just because it issued a show cause order.
But didn't the government also cite cases to the CCA that said it was not required? And so, again, why are we concluding that the CCA felt they were required to do this? And if they did not feel that they were required and simply in this case decided it was appropriately, why is this not improvidently granted, this issue?
Well, because, Your Honor, the CCA indicated in its – you do have the benefit of the CCA's analysis in this instance because it issued a remand order. And in that remand order, it cites 1104D as the only way to correct a record. And that is error and an incorrect interpretation of the law. Chief Justice Shtuki, I see that my time has expired. May I?
Thank you, counsel.
Sure.
Does the appellant have a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Beginning with a couple of questions asked by Judge Sparks and Judge Ryan, I would like to note that when the appellant attempted to attach the record, the memorandum from the convening authority, at that point in time, we did identify in our motion that this was relevant to a potential supplemental assignment of errors. And we would posit that if AFSCCA, applying Rule 15.5, believed that appellant was precluded from filing a supplemental AOE, they would have no reason to attach the document to the record of trial. So we believe that that was the rationale for denying the document rather than relevance. We would also like to point out that the convening authority's memorandum was relevant for two reasons. One, it went towards the UCI issue, but it also went to the post-trial delay. And the document itself was dated 25 days after the court remanded the case back for certificate of correction. And what we put in our motion to attach is it basically shows that it was a dilatory response by the government. So we think that it was relevant for that reason as well. And this actually goes to a point that the government made regarding Air Force Court's TARDIF analysis. And they said that the government said that the Air Force Court had before it all of the evidence it needed to decide TARDIF relief. But we point to that convening authority memorandum and from the EOT itself, from the government, that was a potentially misleading statement. And that stated that the legal office, the convening authority's legal office, was working diligently to comply with the court's order. Now, we believe that that on its face, and by the way, my friend over here, I'm not alleging anything against my friend over here. He's only as good as the information he's provided from the legal office. But the fact is that the court looked at that document from the government, said they were diligently working towards this, and yet you have a convening authority memorandum that was dated 25 days after the court's order. So we believe it was relevant for that purpose, and that would defeat their argument about the Air Force Court having all the facts in front of it. We would also like to note that there is no factual predicate required for an AOE, and this goes into what Chief Judge Stuckey talked about. Allende and Brock, both cited by the government, talks about how the appellant failed to substantiate his claims. But nevertheless, the lower court considered those claims themselves. And that's what we have here. It frankly doesn't matter if we didn't have the facts to back up the claim. That's something for the court to have decided as it considers the claim itself. It's not a rationale for denying review wholesale. And that's what occurred in this case. We would also like to point out, and this goes to Judge Olson's question about the timing of this, and the government responded that appellant never refiled this case. They had a chance to refile it, and they never did. Well, again, our position is that our 10-day clock started on the 30th of November. And if you look at the timing of this, Your Honors, recon, this case progressed from supplemental AOE to motions to attach to recon to a decision on reconsideration all within the 60 days allotted by Joint Rule 15B. Under Joint Rule 15B, Aaron Mueller had until the 29th of January 2019 to submit his claims. And the Air Force Court denied reconsideration on the 28th of January 2019.
Counsel, I think the government's position was that there was no proffer of any claims that might have been submitted during that 60, no proffer of any additional claims that might have been submitted within that 60-day period. What's the response to that?
Your Honor, they're relying on Gilley for that proposition, and that's just a fundamental misunderstanding of Gilley. What happened in Gilley was the Air Force Court had implemented a 7-day rule to file a supplemental AOE on remand. And in that case, Gilley allege that this rule was invalid somehow, but during that 7 days, he never articulated any issue he would have raised or how the rule actually applied to him.
Well, let me just ask you this. At this point, can you proffer any claim that you would have raised during that 60-day period?
Your Honor, I think that and this goes back to the point about the affidavit being not substantiated with the VA claim or with other employers. And I would proffer, Your Honor, that if we had additional time, we might have been able to substantiate those claims. We only had 10 days to submit those matters, and within that time we had those 60 days. And I'd like to point out, though, too, Your Honor, that in our motion to recon, we actually discussed the due process rights of the appellant to have these issues reviewed. We discussed how the rule was invalid because it conflicted with the UCMJ, conflicted with the other rules. Frankly, we don't believe that we needed to refile any additional claims. We believe that we had a valid claim in front of the court at that time, and Article 66 provides a substantial right to a client, to an appellant. We did not get that substantial right, and that's the due process error in this case, Your Honor. Any other further questions, Your Honor? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess until 0900 tomorrow morning.
Rise. Court stands in recess until 9 a.m.